Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Live by the rich, die by the rich. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. As California's budget drama drags on, many people say, let's tax the rich. Well, turns out we do. That's why state revenue has unexpectedly gone up by $6.6 billion, but it's also one of the reasons state finances are in such a mess. What goes up can also, unexpectedly, come down. We'll have more on that tonight as Frank and Jamie McCourt get into another dispute about financing the Dodgers. Later on, President Obama and change in the Middle East. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. President Obama has made his second major address on the Middle East and North Africa. Later on, we'll hear how he thinks the U.S. needs to adapt to changes brought on by the so-called Arab Spring and what he thinks they mean for Israel and the Palestinians. First, a new chapter in the saga of Frank and Jamie McCourt. She wants to sell the Dodgers. He does not. Yesterday and today, they exchanged court filings on whether she has any right to interfere with a deal he claims will give him a chance to make payroll before the end of the month. Bill Shakin is baseball columnist for the LA Times. Bill, always good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon.
What if he can't make payroll by May 31st?
If he can't make payroll, clearly the players need to be paid, so do the rest of the employees. Major League Baseball would step in and take care of it at that time. The trade-off would be they'd want him to put the team up for sale, and if he didn't, they would seize the team from him and take care of that themselves.
What's the deal that he wants to make in the meantime?
The same deal he's been talking about now for a couple weeks, a long-term television contract with Fox that would keep the Dodgers on the Fox channels, locally Prime Ticket and Fox Sports West, for 17 years. And in exchange, McCourt would get a lot of money, and that money could be used to resolve the Dodgers' financial problems in the way Mr. McCourt says.
And presumably he could get some enough money to make payroll from that deal before the end of the month?
Well, that and a lot more. I mean, what he's told Major League Baseball is, I could use this money to resolve my divorce. I could use this money to manage my debt. I could use this money to improve the team. They've made clear that they don't want that money used for anything other than improving the team. And Mr. McCourt has agreed to rework the deal to their satisfaction if they're willing to talk about it.
Now, Jamie McCourt filed yesterday, and she said that she wants to sell immediately. Why?
What she says is, as presumptive half-owner of the team under California community property law, and I should say that Frank McCourt disputes that at this point, but as her position of half-owner would say, look, if this team needs to be sold, you're hurting the value in the way you're operating the team. And as a result, I think the judge should order the team sold now so that the value doesn't go down any farther. Because if we sell and the value goes down, we each end up with less.
How does he respond to that?
He doesn't think he's running down the value at all. In fact, he cites, and his attorneys do, that the value of the team has gone up since he got to town. And in fact, even over the last couple tumultuous years.
Well, now, Judge Scott Gordon set the next hearing for June the 22nd. If that's the case, will all this be in a limbo, and will he then inevitably not be able to make payroll by May 31st and lose the team?
That all remains to be seen. I mean, all we know at this point is there's a hearing on June 22nd. Both sides are going to try to work toward a settlement yet again before that date. And Major League Baseball would have the option to do something if Frank McCourt can't meet payroll, which, again, also has yet to be seen.
Do you get a sense of how the fans are feeling about all this now?
You know, from the emails we get, I think there's a little weariness, and I think that is even true on both parties, given the read of the lawyers this morning in court. This has gone on for close to 2 years now. We really aren't any closer to a resolution, it appears, than we were 2 years ago. And I think people are ready for some sort of resolution, whatever it's going to be, because, frankly, the headlines have been off the field for way too long.
I take it that at the same time, attendance is going down and the team's not doing all that great.
Right. And there's very much a question of how much has to do with the ownership situation and how much has to do, in terms of the attendance, with well, the team wasn't very good last year, and that's how you sell a lot of season tickets. Certainly there were some security concerns at the beginning of the season when the LAPD had to come and essentially take over stadium security after the incident in the parking lot when a Giants fan was attacked. You know, the economy still isn't great. So it's any number of things, but certainly when you turn on your TV and see a stadium half empty, that doesn't do anyone any good.
That Giants fan is still hospitalized, went back to San Francisco. Apparently he did open his eyes for the first time in the very recent past. But all this could be over then by the 31st of May.
It's possible. You know, I hate to say what's going to happen because that's the one thing that we figure in this case. It always goes the other way when you think you know what's going to happen.
It's like trying to predict the end of the game in the ninth inning.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Bill Shakin, the baseball columnist for the L.A. Times. Thanks, as always, for being on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. California's dependence on wealthy taxpayers brought some good news this week with $6.6 billion in new unexpected revenue. But in the future, bad news is virtually inevitable for the same reason. Robert Frank writes the Wealth Report blog for the Wall Street Journal. He's author of Richistan, A Journey Through American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. Robert Frank, good to have you on our program.
Great to be here.
Explain what appears to be a paradox. We depend on the rich, but there are good times and bad times, I guess, is the way to put it.
That's right. Well, in California, like many states, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, the top 1% of taxpayers, in other words, the highest 1% of earners, pay more than 40% of the personal income taxes in California. Now, this is terrific in good times, especially when stock markets are doing well and when tech is doing well, as we're seeing today and really in the past year or two when stock markets have rebounded. The downside of this is when stock markets go down and the incomes of the wealthy crash, then all of a sudden we have a huge deficit like we had in California.
Other states too?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a problem that really is rooted in the growing income gap in America. So it's not just a California phenomenon, although it is a little more exaggerated in California because of their more progressive income tax and because you do have wider inequality in California. But New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, other states that have a high reliance on personal income taxes have been through exactly the same thing. During the bull markets of the late 90s and in the mid-2000s, these states were awash in revenues, and all the politicians mistook those revenues as a sustainable revenue stream. In other words, they thought these wealthy people and stock markets were just going to keep going up and up, and they built their budgets around what essentially turned out to be fake or certainly fleeting revenues.
So they're building ongoing, continuing expenditures then into the budgets based on revenues that might or might not be there.
Exactly. And you know, if you look at California, so they had, you know, let's call it $20 billion deficit, whatever it might have been, more than half of that was caused by a decline in the personal income taxes from the wealthy. In California alone, those personal income taxes dropped by $10 billion. Other states were the same thing. Now, so if the basic lesson here is that as go the wealthy, so go the states. So in other words, if we want to find out where the states are headed, all we have to do is look at what's happening with the incomes of the wealthy. And what's strange is over the past 2 years, the wealthy have recovered from this recession because of financial markets, whereas the rest of us who rely on jobs and our houses for our wealth are really still stuck in recession.
So what then might be done about what appears to be entirely predictable?
Well, there are really just two things you can do. One of them is to broaden the tax base. In other words, either lower taxes on the wealthy or raise them for everyone else or do both. Politically, that's extremely difficult to do, especially at a time when the income gap between the wealthy and everyone else is rising. So if that's off the table, what you really have to do is figure out a way to build strong rainy day funds that allow you to set aside money during these boom times that you can then spend when revenues go off a cliff and stock markets fall.
You could also increase the wages and salaries of those people who you don't call rich, but the government can't do that.
Absolutely. I mean, that would be mm-hmm. the dream scenario, right, is to create more widespread prosperity. Unfortunately, you know, that just hasn't happened. And we're seeing these broader forces of inequality just grow. So if we concede the fact that inequality is going to grow, the top 1% is going to continue to have higher wages and incomes than everyone else, then what we have to do is just be able to set aside money during those good times so when the revenues dry up, we're prepared. Unfortunately, not a single state, except for Massachusetts. Massachusetts has done a great job of this recently, and they've kept their strong credit rating as a result. Aside from Massachusetts, no other state has done this or even talked about it.
How long does it appear that the current boom is going to go on, or is that one of those things that neither you nor the finance directors of the states involved is able to predict?
Yeah, no one's able to predict. In fact, I had profiled a guy in California whose job it was to predict revenues in California. And what he ended up learning is that in order to predict state revenues in California, you had to be able to predict the stock market. And by the way, no one can do that. And if they can do it, they're not going to be working for the government of California. But that is the fundamental problem. And, you know, as we're seeing today, there's a LinkedIn IPO that originally was supposed to debut at around $45 a share. It's now up over 90 or 100. We're seeing the beginnings of a new bubble start, especially in tech, especially in California. And so what we've learned about bubbles is they go on longer than we expect, and they're bigger and broader than we expect. So I suspect this is the beginning. This will go on for several years before we have to worry about it again.
Is another solution for the states to take the revenue that comes in as a result of a bubble, presuming that's what it is, and spend it on one-time things, fixing the infrastructure, that sort of stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, setting aside one-time projects during good times is another solution that people have proposed. Unfortunately, you know, when you call something a one-time project, it ends up becoming a recurring project. And so, you know, governments end up basically building into recurring revenues things that they're calling one-time projects. So that's a great idea, but once it gets into the sausage machine of legislatures and politicians, it just never works out that well. But you're absolutely right. That is another way to deal with the problem.
Robert Frank, again, a senior writer for The Wall Street Journal. Gene Ross is executive director of the California Budget Project. That's aimed at some of the people who aren't in the wealthy category, which is most of us. Gene Ross, good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
What's happening in California for everybody else? So what about job growth, for example, in this recovery?
Job growth in the very recent past is actually looking good. California's even doing a bit better than the nation as a whole. However, we are still at the bottom of a very deep hole, and all of the forecasts suggest that we're looking, probably a good 3 to 4 years before we recovered the jobs that we lost in the so-called Great Recession.
This subject that we're talking about with Robert Frank has been well known to this situation, well known in Sacramento, where you hang out, for a very long time. Is anybody addressing it?
It's got strengths and weaknesses. Certainly when the busts happen, that's bad news for the budget. The good news from a revenue standpoint, from a budgetary standpoint, is that we have had some fabulous growth, and apparently last year as well, in the top end of our income distribution, that does produce a large share of tax revenues in California. Unfortunately, it really is only the very top end of our income distribution that's moving forward in terms of income growth relative to inflation. And if you look at California income taxpayers over the past 20 years, the bottom 80% of the income distribution is falling behind. The top is increasing. After adjusting for inflation, that top 1% that Mr. Frank was talking about have seen their incomes pretty much double in California, and that actually includes a bit of a drop in 2009. That once we get the data from last year, and certainly looks like it increased significantly. So we are talking about most Californians. The vast majority of Californians who are not even treading water, they're falling behind.
So as Robert Frank indicated earlier, then, the solution of smoothing things out in terms of who pays how much in revenue is not going to be politically popular. This is not the moment to lower rates on the rich and raise rates on everybody else.
And certainly we have seen some proposals, a blue ribbon tax commission appointed by the last governor, legislative leaders would have shifted who pays taxes in California off the wealthy, particularly off of the wealthy that earn their money from the stock market, on to lower and particularly middle income Californians. I think these are the households that are struggling. They are the middle-income families, upper-middle-income families, who are having a tough time making ends meet. I don't think it's right from an economic standpoint, or certainly from a social standpoint, to ask those families to pay more so that the people who are doing fabulously well can pay less.
Where is the job growth, then? In what sectors? And how long is it expected to last, whether it's good enough to make up the difference or not?
The job growth, we're seeing certainly the tech sector. By all reports, again, as Robert Frank said, Silicon Valley is roaring back. Commercial real estate vacancy levels back down to where they were during the dot-com boom. The public sector is what's holding the economy back. Job losses due to state budget cuts, local budget cuts, school budget cuts, holding things back. So we're seeing, you know, some good growth, but again, I think a lot of reasons for concern. And again, we're looking at, and men are doing far better than women in the recent recovery, which is interesting given that as we went into the downturn, women did a little better than men at the beginning of the downturn. So, but still a couple of tough years ahead of us.
What does Governor Brown propose with regard to the $6.6 billion? I know he made a major announcement about the revised edition of his budget and indicated that he doesn't want to use any of the borrowing devices that his predecessors have.
He has said that. I mean, and it's important to say about half of that money that we're talking about is cash in the bank, income tax returns filed in April. The remainder are taxes that I think it's reasonable to expect we'll all be paying next year when we file our income tax returns. The governor scaled back some of his revenue increase proposals in the May revision released earlier this week, and he put a fair amount of the additional revenues to California's public schools. And a lot of that increase in school funding is driven by our constitutional guarantee, which requires a minimum level of funding for public schools.
What about the rainy day idea? How is he doing there?
We have one in California. We've actually had a pretty strong rainy day fund requirement since 2004, and the problem is this is really the first year that we haven't been in a torrential rainstorm, and we're still in a pretty deep hole. It's important. You know, this is certainly the best news from a budget standpoint that we've had in a long time, but we're still looking at about a $10 billion shortfall that needs to be bridged.
We're talking with Jane Ross, the executive director of the California Budget Project. Back to Robert Frank with the Wall Street Journal. Kind of sounds like more of the same.
Yeah, I mean, look, the fundamental problem here is that the states are addicted to the most dangerous form of revenue, which is the taxes from the wealthy. You know, the revenues and the incomes of the wealthy are the most volatile in our country. During the recession, very few people realize this because we all think the wealthy did fine, whereas in fact, their incomes and their taxes drop more than twice as much than the rest of the country. And the problem is all of the states, for both political and economic reasons, are now addicted to this revenues because, as Jane mentioned before, when times are great, they're just flooding the state coffers with money. And the issue is this is great as long as it lasts, but like a drug, you know, when you're off it, when you're trying to get off of that drug, it's very painful and debilitating. So the states have got to figure out a long-term solution to living with the most volatile form of revenue in the United States, which, as far as I can see, they haven't really addressed.
Gene Ross, again, executive director of the California Budget Project, and the man we just heard, Robert Frank, with the Wall Street Journal, writes the blog The Wealth Report and is also author of Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lies of the New Rich. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
For more information about Which Way L.A. or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way L.A. Steve Cooley has been Los Angeles District Attorney for three terms, longer than anyone else in the past 70 years. His decision this week not to go for a fourth term has energized a crowd of candidates, almost all of whom said they wouldn't run if Cooley sought re-election. Rick Orloff covers local government for the Daily News. Always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Good to be with you.
So he has indicated that he won't run, and he has endorsed his second in charge. Who's that?
Her name is Jackie Lacey. She's an African-American woman and will be the first African-American woman to hold a job. She's very qualified, very knowledgeable. But the question is for all any of these, a lot of the people who are running are also deputy DAs, if they can raise the money or build a base to get well-known.
One of them is the former head of the County Prosecutors Union, who
right.
ran against Cooley in 2008.
Right, and didn't do very well. But Cooley's been an interesting politician in that he's not the traditional type. You don't see him out a lot glad handing, and I think it hurt him in his race for attorney general. He may have been DA for all these years, but no one knew who he was.
So he lost, of course, to an African-American woman.
Kamala Harris, that's right.
Yeah. What about the city attorney, Carmen Trutanich, whom Cooley supported and urged to run for that job, city attorney?
It's an interesting dynamic. Like you say, he recruited and encouraged Carmen Trutanich to run for city attorney against Jack Weiss. And as it's turned out, no one's quite sure if it's because he didn't like Jack Weiss that much or if he really did believe in Carmen Trutanich. Because ever since Trutanich has been in office, their relationship has been distant at best. While they both say the right things, Cooley didn't run out to endorse Trutanich as his successor.
In fact, the reverse. He told him that he should remain the city attorney and not run for DA.
That's right. And Trutanich made a big deal about the fact that if he was elected city attorney, he would not seek higher office. And a lot of his opponents are making hay with that now, saying that he promised to give $100,000 for the best after-school program and take out an ad that he was a liar. And they're all waiting for that.
So Trutanich has set up a campaign, and so has Lacey.
Right.
Are they the top two?
That's what everyone is looking at right now. Of course, we'll really know once the money, the reports start coming in about how much they've raised. And this is going to be a race where money really will talk in this race.
Back to Cooley, as you indicated earlier, he lost to Kamala Harris. He didn't expect to, and he lost in Los Angeles County, among other places. Do you think that sort of soured him on the whole idea of running again? Is he just tired of it?
I think so, but also he is 65. He's been with the DA's office 40 years. He didn't really want to run for attorney general, but was really almost drafted by the Republican Party to do so. And his campaign was... He claims that he campaigned as hard as he could, but a lot of people who watched it were wondering, where was he? We didn't really see him out at events in Los Angeles where he was expected to run well to keep his base, and he didn't do it.
When is the election actually going to occur?
It'll be in next year, in June, and then if no one gets 50% plus one, there'll be a runoff in November.
Are there any events, any major trials coming up, anything that will involve local legal issues, either for the city attorney or the attorney general, that we can look forward to, or is it pretty much a crapshoot at this point?
Pretty much a crapshoot at this point. I mean, the one that had potential for blowing up in Trutanich's face was Lindsay Lohan, but she's up to no contest now. But Cooley was able all his years to really avoid controversy over major trials. You didn't see him getting up front on an O.J. Simpson-type thing like his predecessor, Gil Garcetti, did.
Okay, so we can look for that. Probably relatively quiet on the legal front unless something major occurs, which is always possible.
And with the law, there's always something that could happen. There could be a police shooting. There could be another major demonstration like we had with May Day. And you just never know.
And with the campaign going on, there could always be something happen we might not even want to know about, but we will anyway.
That's true.
Rick Orloff with the Daily News. As always, good to talk with you.
Thank you, Warren. I appreciate it.
Join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, President Obama and change in the Middle East on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. President Obama surveyed the Middle East and North Africa today, from the Arab Spring to the death of Osama bin Laden.
Those shouts of human dignity are being heard across the region. And through the moral force of nonviolence, the people of the region have achieved more change in 6 months than terrorists have accomplished in decades.
2 years ago, he promised a new beginning based on mutual interest. Today, he said, there has to be further change.
Failure to speak to the broader aspirations of ordinary people will only feed the suspicion that has festered for years that the United States pursues our interests at their expense. Given that this mistrust runs both ways, as Americans have been seared by hostage-taking and violent rhetoric and terrorist attacks that have killed thousands of our citizens, a failure to change our approach threatens a deepening spiral of division between the United States and the Arab world.
Brian Katulis is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal think tank with ties to the Obama administration. He's co-author of The Prosperity Agenda, What the World Wants from America and What We Need in Return. Brian Katulis, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What would you say about the speech today? It was indeed sweeping. It covered an enormous number of various different issues. We'll hear bits of it as we go along on our program today. What was the purpose and was it accomplished?
First, I think you're right. This was a very ambitious speech, and I think its purpose was to respond to all of the questions and concerns people had about whether President Obama has an overarching strategy for a region that's in transformation. And I think he laid out some very important principles, but I also think that this speech may go down as being referred to as the then what speech, because I think he laid out important markers on U.S. support for democratic transitions in the region. He said, quote, America values the dignity of the street vendor more than the power of the dictator. And he also did not avoid the Arab-Israeli conflict and said that the U.S. would stay engaged on it, and said some important things. But I think many people in the region and people who are analyzing the policy will say, well, then what? If Assad continues to crack down in Syria, will there be consequences, and what will those look like? Bahrain got some mention in there. And, you know, the one country, though, that didn't get mentioned, though, was Saudi Arabia, which is vitally important to what's going on in the region and vitally important to the global energy markets. So as ambitious as it was, and I think it was laid out a clear marker, I think the key question then is, how is the administration going to move forward on supporting democratic transitions and trying to restart the Arab-Israeli peace process?
Here's what he said about Bahrain, not just Bahrain, but also Yemen, important because those are countries where dictators remain in power, and dictators who have had support from the United States in the past.
If America's to be credible, we must acknowledge that at times our friends in the region have not all reacted to the demands for consistent change with change that's consistent with the principles that I've outlined today. That's true in Yemen, where President Saleh needs to follow through on his commitment to transfer power. And that's true today in Bahrain.
Fares Brezat is a professor of political science and head of the public opinion program at the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies based in Doha, Qatar. Thank you very much for joining us today, Professor.
Thank you.
The president was very critical, very outspoken, of course, about the president of Syria, Mr. Assad, and, of course, about Gaddafi in Libya as well. How important do you think it will be in the Middle East to hear him say what we just heard about what's happening in Yemen and Bahrain?
First, I think the speech was a remarkable to mark the difference if you compare it to the Cairo speech 2 years ago, which raised hopes. So so high in the region, but still public opinion, the people of the region were very disappointed in the 2 years that followed. President Obama did not deliver any of the things that he promised, and people were disappointed. I think this speech is different in one sense, that it talks about the people of the region who took the future into their own hands without relying on American support or on support from their government. It's the people who revolted against their governments, against repression, and that repression is not only against the dictators they rule them, but also it's all forms of repression, including the delegitimization of political violence, when we can see this through tracking popularity of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden in the region that has been going down over the past few years. But I think what is important as far as the people of the region are concerned is the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is the heart of the matter. And the President Obama did not say much or anything new in that regard. He reiterated commitment somehow to a Jewish democratic state. Now, Jewish democratic is a contradiction in terms. You cannot be ethnically or religiously clean without any other ethnic groups or religious minorities or religious groups and remain to be democratic, although we know that 20% of the citizens of the state of Israel are Arabs. So what does that mean? And is that going to lead to reactivation of the peace process? I doubt very much, because I think the Palestinians will not welcome that. And talk about demilitarized Palestinian state is something that is unacceptable for the Palestinians either. And I think he was more in tone and line with the Israeli narrative and the Israeli point of view more than it is with the Palestinian or the Arab at large. And I think in that sense, there will be a big disappointment in the near future, because there isn't much change. And I think President Obama, he mentioned something about the peace process that is not delivering. And it is up to him to put pressure on the Israelis to deliver and to accept what is acceptable. And the Palestinians are demanding a state within the 1967 borders. But he did not mention anything about settlements, which are spreading in the West Bank and the occupied territory, illegal settlements. They are being built on regular basis, and they are expanding. And this is one fundamental problem facing negotiations and the peace process. So I really don't think all these will increase or improve the credibility of the United States and the President Obama in particular. One other point I'd like also to mention, that
let me ask you to hold on for a moment, if you will, because I want our listeners to hear a little bit more of what President Obama had to say, and then we'll get another view on this and come back to you, Professor Brezat, again at the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies in Doha, Qatar. He said that many people believe that the peace process is moribund at this point, but said that he doesn't agree with that.
Indeed, there are those who argue that with all the change and uncertainty in the region, it is simply not possible to move forward now. I disagree. At a time when the people of the Middle East and North Africa are casting off the burdens of the past, the drive for a lasting peace that ends the conflict and resolves all claims is more urgent than ever.
Now, he did say that he was critical of the settlements. At least he mentioned the settlements and said that they were an obstacle to peace. He also called for a Palestinian state along the 1967 boundaries. David Makovsky, a senior fellow and director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, former editor of the Jerusalem Post, author of Making Peace with the PLO, the Rabin Government's Road to the Oslo Accord. David Makovsky, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be back with you, Warren.
Do you agree with Professor Brezat that what he said wasn't enough to get the process moving again?
No, I'd like to respectfully disagree with the professor. I didn't have that view at all. I've heard President Abbas say on many times in public, first of all, that he wants the state to be non-militarized or demilitarized. That's a Palestinian position that is often repeated.
And the president said that today. He said it should be a demilitarized.
Yeah, he didn't say anything different than what President Abbas has said many times. Mm-hmm. A. B. He also, on settlements, as you pointed out, he did refer to that in a kind of a disapproving tone. But his point is that let's try to get the territorial and security dimensions of this problem resolved. And he put down for the first time what I would call, what he would like to see is American terms of reference for these talks. Now, you have to follow all these nuances, but since the start of the administration, Hillary Clinton has used a different term, saying, we know what the Palestinians want. They want that the baseline is the 67 borders with territorial swaps. That means offsetting land. We know the Israelis want to maintain Israel as a Jewish state. We, our American position is that these positions are reconcilable. Where the president changed that today is instead of using the Hillary Clinton language, which he started in November 2009, he's now saying this is the American position and that this will be the baseline, in his view, for the negotiations. He's saying that the issues of Jerusalem and refugees, however, are not going to be solved immediately. These are two narrative issues that cut to the self-definition of the parties because they involve things like religion and nationalism. And unless these leaders really condition the societal landscapes of their own publics, the odds are if it's all or nothing, it's going to be nothing. So he's putting forward a position that Prime Minister Netanyahu probably is not going to like because Netanyahu has not said that, although Netanyahu made a step towards that in the Israeli Knesset speech, the Israeli parliament this Monday, for the first time saying that he knows that a deal would mean yielding a large majority of the West Bank. But he has not gone as far as the president's formulation. The president has gone farther than Netanyahu, but at the same time, he's saying if it's all or nothing in the Middle East, the odds are it's nothing.
Okay, David Makovsky again at the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We're told by the Associated Press that Prime Minister Netanyahu has already said in response to the president's speech that the 1967 lines would be indefensible. I want to go back now to Professor Brezat in Qatar. You said there was nothing much new here. What about calling for the 1967 boundaries?
Well, I think we will have to see. These calls, they have been made before in different forms and in different ways, but always it comes down to what the Israelis want and what they wouldn't accept. And I think now the whole process has been derailed because you have a shift of power in the region. Now people are taking matters into their own hands in important countries. This is happening in Egypt. It happened in Tunisia. It is happening as we speak in Syria. These are important countries to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I don't think even if the Americans would push for something that that the Israelis would be okay with, I don't think that will move forward because also the Israelis will not be able to fulfill or to meet the demands of the Palestinians. The Palestinians would like to have a West Bank that is free of settlements, and the Israelis are not willing to do this. They want to unify Jerusalem as their capital, and they are not going to give up on that. And this has been talked about over the past 17 years or so, and nothing was delivered. And these were the sticky issues.
I do want to go on to some other points, but David Makovsky in Jerusalem for the Middle East Peace Process Project. Quickly, are you any more optimistic than Professor Brezat that this is going to get negotiations going anytime soon?
Look, no one's ever gone broke being pessimistic about the Middle East. So, you know, to say the word optimism is almost to open yourself up for ridicule. But I think what's important here is the president, by putting forward this basically these terms of reference, he's given these talks a chance. And when you say the 67 lines, what he said, and you know, very clearly, was what he calls the swaps, which means that it's not the exact way it was in 1967. But if they if it changes a little bit, that Israel has certain areas that it wants to keep, it has to give offsetting equal amount of areas somewhere else. And that's why there's a realistic dimension of this, and it's also why it deals with the issue of settlements. And this is, I think, an important point for your listeners, because the whole idea is to say, let's focus on getting a border between these countries, because once there's a border, there's no more settlements. If it's a settlement that's in the border of Israel, it's now called Israel. And if it's outside of the border, it's gone. And I think, you know, that's why it's not just pie in the sky. And I think also, to be fair, the president also, by making it clear that it's not just about land, it's accepting each side recognizing the other. And the characters of their country. If it's Palestine for the Palestinians with equal rights for its citizens, and Israel, a nation state of the Jewish people, but with equal rights for its citizens. Because the Israelis feel that no matter how much land they give, it doesn't matter, because the Arabs don't really accept them in the region. The Palestinians believe it's about the land. This deals with the gut fears of each side.
Okay, we're going to have to leave the Middle East at this point, because there are, as I said, other issues in the speech that I want to address. One of the things that there were not one, but the president listed several economic forms of assistance, particularly to Tunisia and Egypt, and to the region in general. Here's what he had to say:
if you take out oil exports, this entire region of over 400 million people exports roughly the same amount as Switzerland. So we will work with the EU to facilitate more trade within the region, build on existing agreements to promote integration with U.S. and European markets, and open the door for those countries who adopt high standards of reform and trade liberalization to construct a regional trade arrangement.
Still with us, our first guest, Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, once again, think tank with ties to the Obama administration. He went on at some length with a number of different proposals of an economic kind. What do you think is going to be the influence of that?
I think what President Obama outlined here is what I like to call his prosperity agenda for the Middle East. The word prosperity came up quite a lot, and he understands pragmatically, I think, at its core, the economic problems in places like Egypt, if they're not fully addressed, could actually overwhelm Egypt and lead to a political and security crisis. I think things have gone fairly well so far in Egypt, as well as one could hope in their political transition, but we're still very, very early in this process. And I think there's a very real risk that if we're not doing the sorts of things that the president outlined in the speech, which I think, as he highlighted, will be coupled with other international efforts, we could run the risk of and the danger of people asking questions of who lost Egypt by 2012, because this is a very delicate, complicated transition, both economically and politically, that they're going through. So I think what the president outlined is important. I wouldn't call it a Marshall Plan, as some people have said, because it's actually quite modest in its size and scope. I would rather call it a marshalling plan, where we're trying to marshal a number of resources, including leveraging the assets of the private sector, because a big part of this are loan guarantees and helping spark private investment and job creation that way, and also getting others to pull their weight, which I think, you know, getting other countries to also contribute, and also international institutions. This is where, again, going back to my main point, the then what? The implementation of all of this, I think, is going to be very important, because as Secretary Clinton announced in March, we were reprogramming $150 million of assistance to help Egypt. It's taken them 2 months, and they finally have reprogrammed that assistance. We need to move more quickly and spend more time sort of analyzing the actual policy implementation, as opposed to what the president's speech is.
Okay, Brian Katulis, again, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. I understand you need to leave us on your way to the White House. So thanks very much for being on our program today.
Great, thank you.
I want to turn now to a very distinguished veteran of politics and policy in the Middle East, Gary Sick. He's former director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. He's now a senior research scholar there. He served on the National Security Council staff under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan. He's author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran. Gary Sick, it's always good to have you on our program, and thanks for joining us again.
Pleasure to be with you.
I understand that you made a checklist ahead of time to that you could refer to after the president had made his speech. What was on the list, and how did he come down?
Well, the list was fairly long, but the main part of it was that I truly believe that the United States, given the new situation in the Middle East, really needs to have a reset of its foreign policy. I think there are a series of assumptions that we have used in the past, basically saying that nothing is going to change, that these rulers remain in place, that the changes are just a tiny little increment here and there, and that basically tomorrow will look just about like yesterday. All of those assumptions, I think, are incorrect now. And so I was particularly interested in watching, did Obama, in fact, reset our strategy? Did he do something that, in fact, laid out a new way of thinking about our policy? Well, he certainly made some new suggestions. One that he said that I agree with very much, which he didn't focus on very much, was the fact that the United States, one, didn't start all of this, and actually has little control over the thing. And I think the recognition that the United States cannot do it all is really a very important one. And if that gets cranked into our policies, I think that's very healthy. There are, however, a number of other things. For instance, the speech really had two parts. And the two-thirds of the speech was about the Arab Spring and the changes that are going on. And the last piece of it was about the Arab-Israel issue. And I was struck by the fact that he put Arab Israel off at the end and gave it not nearly as much time and attention as he did the other. I was particularly concerned about how do you fit these two pieces together. So you want to deal with the Arab Israel issue, but you've got all of these changes that are taking place all over the Middle East. How do you, in fact, make progress on the Arab-Israel issue if you're also forced to, in effect, improvise and deal with a new set of policies that are all coming from the rest of the Middle East, especially where the rest of the Middle East is going to, presumably, the people of the region are going to be heard a lot more loudly than they have in the past. And I think that creates really huge problems for the United States and for Israel, in the sense that we've taken it for granted that there would be a number of dictators who basically had made their decision about which side they were on, and they would carry out policies, often policies that we wanted them to carry out, pretty much without respect to what their own people thought or said. It seems to me that day is over, and I'm not at all convinced that we've managed to fit these two pieces together. But I was also struck, when we get back to Saudi Arabia, that Saudi Arabia's policies and the Gulf Cooperation Council policies have changed rather dramatically in the last couple of months, where Saudi Arabia has introduced troops into Bahrain, which is a really radically new step, all in the name of the Gulf Cooperation Council. And the GCC is talking about bringing in other monarchs in the region, Jordan and Morocco, for instance. This is all very, very new, and there was not a hint that any of that was going on. So on one hand, we have enormous change and people-driven change in the part of the Arab world. In the other, we have a really counter-revolutionary movement that is saying we want nothing to do with any of this. And I'm not suggesting that the answer to that problem is easy, but I think in a speech where he was supposed to reset U.S. policy in the region, these are some huge glaring omissions that are going to have to be filled in later.
Here's the way the president ended his speech, and I'm going to ask Gary Sick to comment on this.
The United States of America was founded on the belief that people should govern themselves. And now we cannot hesitate to stand squarely on the side of those who are reaching for their rights, knowing that their success will bring about a world that is more peaceful, more stable, and more just.
So, Gary Sick, is your reaction to that what next?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm really very happy to see the United States put itself on that side of history, basically taking the position that we really identify with the people. That is something very new. I don't think we've ever talked about identifying with the people of the Middle East at any time in the past. It's always been their governments, and it's moving these states around on the chessboard. It seems to me that the chessboard has been turned over, that the pieces are all flying, and trying to put it all back together again. But basically, taking the point that we care about the people and that we actually are committed to a move toward greater democracy seems to me something that the United States can live with, and it provides at least one cornerstone of a policy that I hope is going to emerge.
Gary Sick, again, formerly with the Middle East Institute at Columbia and on the National Security Council staff under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan. Thanks to you. Thanks to David McCoskey in Jerusalem, Professor Fares Brezat in Qatar, and our earlier guest, Brian Katulis, with the Center for American Progress. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Katie Cooper, Christian Bordahl, and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla, or join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.